many of you, but not all of you, know who Joko Beck is, or in this case was. That's the point today. Joko Beck died Wednesday after a long, long, wonderful teaching career and a long illness. And she was just, there was a, saw a photo of a tiny little wisp of Joko in a bed before she died. She had a very long teaching career, first in Los Angeles and then in San Diego. I meant to bring in her books for show and tell. She was one of the very first women Zen teachers in the West, and one of the first Zen teachers anywhere or in the in our era to really emphasize attention to feeling and emotion as part of paying attention to the mind. As a part of our awakening practice, rather than as something to be somehow tucked under the cushion. She did, her practice was a kind of a combination of a mindfulness of body and mind and the just sitting that we call Shikantaza. And she's, if one of Karen Chevron practiced with her for some time, and you know, Joko met her on a couple of occasions. I don't know if any of our Joko. I never met her personally. Did you?
I sat with her when I was in San Diego.
Yeah. Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Many of us encountered her books. The first one was called Everyday Zen, and the second one, Nothing Special. And I remember when I first started practicing with Tozen, he said, that's the best American Zen teacher's book. He admired it too. Very straightforward and clear teaching. So what I want to do today is sort of pay homage to her through her words and teaching and my thoughts in relation to hers. She had she taught many people. She also created a number of Dharma heirs, and several of them have teach widely, and several of them have written books, which some of you have read. Barry Magid has written two books. Diane Rosetto in Oakland has written on Zen and work, I think. And Ezra Beda has written a couple of interesting books as well, and writes essays and articles. And two of them are teaching at the center in San Diego, and others are teaching in other places. Very strong outflow from her teaching in terms of her Dharma heirs and in terms of all the influence on the rest of us. She was tough, but she was a tough teacher. Kind of a spitfire in a way, not angry, but energetic and strongly focused as a teacher. And then when Sishin was over, there would be a much more relaxed and easygoing Joko to encounter. She said, we run our life avoiding and pursuing. You know, avoiding what gives us pain or hurts, what displeases us, and pursuing what we think will give us pleasure and satisfaction. She said, without exception, we all do this. We remain separate from our life. Underneath our nice, friendly facades, there is great unease. And if I were to scratch below the surface of anyone, I would find fear, pain, and anxiety running amok. She paid a lot of attention in her teaching to fear, to the kind of, as a sort of a universal substrate of our experience. Said we need to see through the mirage that there is an I separate from that. Our practice is to close the gap. Said enlightenment is not something you achieve, it's the absence of something, which we forget. Enlightenment is dropping all the goal seeking and all the pursuing of objectives and all the going forward after something. Enlightenment is absence. And we forget that because we, in our minds, turn enlightenment into either a thing or at least a state, a desirable state where we would like to live. In fact, going back to the very origins of Dharma, nirvana means cessation or extinction. But it's not that you get erased. It's the cessation of delusion, the cessation of ignorance, the cessation of this fear and anxiety running amok. That's what is That's what ceases. So she said, our practice or enlightenment, this is the dropping off of all of this goal-seeking, me-burnishing kinds of behaviors, activities. Dropping off our goals and regrets and agendas, all our self-conceits. So this is what we do, but it is not the same as what happens. So say, we do the activity of dropping off, of letting go. We call opening the hand of thought is the same dropping off. And this activity of dropping off, she described in terms of paying attention to the mind and emotions. And letting, as she said, emotions melt. She says, of course, it's a hard act. It's not an easy thing to do. Doing this dropping off, we're still doing. You see, this is humans do. We're trying to pare down in this situation, not in all our lives. We're not saying never do anything. Right? Saying in this time of your practice, can you pare down doing in such a way that there's no object that you're doing? You're not doing something for some, because doing something is always for some purpose, and guess what the purpose is? No. This dropping off has no direct object. We don't make something, we don't alter something, we don't acquire anything, and we don't actually lose anything either. The practice of trying to lose our emotions reminds me of last week. I had a bunch of little styrofoam beads. I couldn't lose them off my hands. You know, they stick. They don't weigh anything, but they stick. They won't go away. We don't lose our personal qualities, our emotions and our thoughts and our even our sticky thoughts. We don't lose themselves easily, and we try to do that, and then we get stuck in activity of making them the enemy. She didn't have a practice with enemies. But she's made clear that this is not an easy thing to do. She saw practice as a kind of a very not quite an Olympic activity, but a really dedicated kind of activity. And what are you doing? There is no next. This is where you're living. You arrive here. Okay, you arrive here, and now. The whole point of dropping off all of the stuff going on is to arrive here and now. And what's the point of arriving here and now? Why go to all that trouble? She talked a lot about that. As many people stop their practice at this point, or kind of freezes in midstream, you kind of say, well, I arrive here and now, over and over and over. That's fine. That is what, operationally, that's what we're doing. When you drop off all the mishigas, all the stuff, all the complicated ideas and goals, and you find that you're here. You do arrive here and now. And this is what's happening. But why are you doing this practice of arriving here? What is it about? And what is here, anyway? Generally, what we might come up with is the idea of it will find peace. That's a something, whoops, right? That we'll find here. A sense of quiet and repose is one face of our practice. A sense of peace, of not being at war. The sense of what drops off is that endless war. What I want, what I don't want, what I can have, what I can't have. That war drops off for the moment, and the absence of that war, as Shakyamuni pointed out, is experienced as peace. But that isn't this personal experience of peace is not the be-all and end-all either. It's not something that you just do over and over to get a fix of peace. Mm-hmm. If you try to make it the point or the goal of your practice, what happens is you have to shut out a whole lot of life. You don't really notice that at the time. So to have this feeling of peacefulness, you have to exclude a whole lot. A whole lot doesn't fit into that little self-concept or self-experience. And she spoke a lot about what we identify with. This is identifying with a peaceful person. This is the peaceful person. And excluding what doesn't fit that. Because you have to throw out a whole lot of your life and a whole lot of your vitality if you say, I'm going to have just these qualities or just the way I feel in this particular circumstance. Well, but there are a lot of other circumstances in your life with a lot of vitality and information in them. That there's a lot of what is new and fermenting is winds up being outside of the boundaries of feeling just peaceful in this moment. Not that you isn't something good to do, but it's not a complete be-all and end-all. It's certainly not your whole experience. So then we wind up having a practice where we say, my practice is when I'm sitting here feeling peaceful, and the rest of it, oh my God. You know. Or then we say, how can I bring my practice into my life? Because we feel the gap. It's a very good question. But the place to start that is actually on the cushion, not just outside, or both ends. You got to work from both ends. How do I integrate my daily life and my practice? You got to work from both sides. You got to say, what in my daily life is, how do I live here in terms of what I understand in my belly about peace or in my life about precepts or about my interconnection with others? But you have to equally do it in the kind of practice you're doing in Zazen. It's equally important for that bridging that perceived gap between me and you or my peaceful or formal Zazen practice and the rest of life. When all those ancient Zen texts talk about watching out for picking and choosing mind, don't pick and choose. Don't set heaven and earth apart. Well, in fact, we have to make choices at every moment. Choosing to come here today, choosing to do something else. There's this the aspect in which there's this one body and this in this moment and has to do something and not do something. We're always making choices. It would be either impossible or derelict not to. And you certainly wouldn't learn anything new. So that's not what they meant. They were not talking about nihilism when they said no picking and choosing. They were saying, don't pick, oh, I'll have just these experiences and not those. I'll go for a certain kind of personal state of feeling peaceful and be what I call peaceful person, excluding the rest of my life. It doesn't work very well. A lot of your energy winds up going to excluding instead of being peaceful, more and more of it. Right? All that gatekeeping is very tiring. So Joko said, as we identify ourselves with less and less of what we think and do and own and want, we can include more and more in our lives. We have the idea that because this clamoring life and our own complexity really presses on us, that if we could only get it to move away a little bit, then we can have peace and quiet. And that we want to identify with this that we're having. And what happened, that this will be more peaceful or better somehow. But it's really sort of the inverse, because as I said, she didn't put it quite that way, we spend an awful lot of our time keeping things at bay that are not part of what we want to experience. Which means we're still in the same old mode. We're still saying, this is me and I don't want to have this. This is the part of me I don't want to have. This is the experience of my life I don't want to have. And so we're still identifying with all of these difficult things and the fact that of grooming myself for what I want to have. And as we spend less and less of our energy on being clinging or attaching to either ideas of what we want and don't want, that's basically what identifying with things is clinging to what I want for me and what I don't want to not be me. That's our identifying with the self project. So as we identify with ourselves with less and less, we can include more and more in our lives. Less and less is held at bay, more and more is included and available for to learn something from. And the energy of that is available to our lives. But then, of course, there's what do you do with all that messy stuff? And she talked about this as a kind of a seeming paradox, that we think of holding some things at bay and then stuffing our lives with experiences, the kind of experiences we want to have. That we will be more alive and more vibrant when we are more, the more we eat and stuff in very all different kinds of things and experiences. And she says that this not attaching, not clinging, not rejecting is the vow of the Bodhisattva. Said, to the degree to which our practice ripens, to that degree we can include more, we can serve more, and that's really what Zen practice is about. Now, to unpack this a bit, first she said, in a way, you have to keep returning to a sense of the larger picture. She focused a great deal on the emotion, what's going on with your body and mind right now. A friend of mine, a Zen teacher, posted, we were having little Zen teacher exchanges about Joko, and that she was taking sort of an early retirement from her life as a labor lawyer. She was in the thick of things and I think she was probably already heading towards becoming a Zen priest. And she went and she sat with Joko Beck in a sesshin, and she wanted to talk about all of this turmoil about leaving law and what, she, you know, what that had been and how the impact and what she was going to do. Joko didn't want to hear anybody. She said, what's going on in your body right now? What's happening right now? The sesshin mind for her, the sesshin activity was, what's going on here right now? What are you living with right now? And then after sesshin, she could sit and talk with you. You know, when we talk, we talk about almost anything. But there's also a time when you have to say, now, what is happening right now in your body and your mind? And behind that, to say, what is the point of sort of arriving here and now? So Joko said, already we are the Buddha. There's just no doubt about that. How could we be anything else? We're all right here now. Where else could we be? But the point is to realize clearly what this means, this harmony, this total oneness, and to be able to express that clearly in our lives, and that's what takes endless work and training. It takes guts, she said. It's not easy. It takes a real devotion to ourselves and to other people. We do not practice just for ourselves. It would not benefit others or ourselves because it remains too narrowly defined. As we patiently sit, something builds within us, working with a good teacher, seeing what she or he is, and we are slowly transformed in this practice. It's not by anything we figure out in our heads. We're transformed by what we do. And what is it that we do? We constantly make that choice. We give up our ego-centered dreams for this reality that we really are. So over and over, we to take the risk. It feels risky very, very often. Any one moment to let go of the whole parade of what's going on, of what I think is going on about myself. But it's in loosening that convulsive grip, we discover that when we're in that grip of our parade, our view has gotten very narrow and reductive. And loosening that grip, our world widens, the view widens, and much more is included. It actually happens in an experiential way that it's only when we really actually open the hand of this clinging to what's really, you know that how it is. This is what really matters, and I really have to do it this way. And we're caught in that. And when whether we or someone else kindly knocks us on the upside the head or does something, and we open out from that, we discover that our life is not that. That was a very narrow and reductive way to see, and very painful. That narrowing is very painful for ourselves and often for others, because there's a whole lot of energy in a very narrow channel. And there is a whole lot more than to include in our lives, including probably new solutions to whatever we were so focused on. Because our focus excludes the new information and the new solutions. She called this kind of attention that we want to be able to pay closely to what is actually here and now in our body, in our mind, in this world, not to the just the pressing ego demand of our thoughts and emotions. She called this witnessing. That's one of the words she had for it. Paying attention to the psyche, the mind, the thoughts, the emotions, all in service of transformation of the self into being in life, not being in a narrow, tiny chamber. She described an intelligent, persistent filtering of the various characteristics of body and mind through Zazen. She said, we see our desires, our needs, our ego drives, and we begin to realize that these patterns, these desires, these addictions are what we've been calling the self. And as our practice continues, we begin to understand the emptiness and impermanence of these patterns, not as a thought, but as an experience. The practice is the experience of seeing the impermanence of these patterns as they are happening in our life, and the emptiness of them. And then she said, they slowly wither away, these addictions, these clinging patterns. She said, when the light of awareness plays on anything, it diminishes the false and encourages the true. With the withering of some of these patterns, no self, which is always present, can begin to show itself with an accompanying increase of peace and joy. I think what she calls no self is what we also call true self, because I don't generally use the no voice. It's a little bit, because we're not saying you don't have a self. We're saying what kind of a self is it? What is it characterized by? What are its qualities? Then she said, at times our life may feel worse than before, as what we have concealed becomes clear. Well, this is difficult and painful practice, but even as this occurs, we have a sense of growing sanity, which is a very good thing. And we learn in our guts, not just in our brain, that a life of joy is not in seeking happiness, but in experiencing and simply being the circumstances of our life as they are. Not fulfilling personal wants, but fulfilling the needs of life, which include your own. She was very strong on not moving from a selfishness to unselfishness. She talked about melting, and I think she took it from a quote that a passage that she refers to in her book. And here she is talking in the late 20th century about facing and experiencing and knowing and attending to our emotion thoughts, as she called them, and all the personal clingings that we have, and and the melting away of them in the light of clarity. Well, and this was very fresh and new, and she was inspired by a great Japanese master of the 18th century named Menzan, and she quotes him, because he said, when through practice you know the reality of Zazen thoroughly, the frozen blockage of emotion thought will naturally melt away. This kind of emotion thought is attachment to a one-sided point of view. And if you think you have cut off illusory thought, instead of clarifying how the clinging emotion thought can naturally melt, if you think you've cut it off, the emotion thought will come up again and again, as though you have cut the trunk of a tree and let the root alive. This cutting off and tossing away, cutting out, cutting away, it doesn't work. She said, Joko then said, a lot of people misunderstand practice as the cutting off of illusory thoughts. Of course they're illusory. But if you cut them off, instead of clarifying their melting, you will learn little. And much of the practice at this center, or San Diego Center, is about clarifying how emotion thought melts. So she said, first we have to see them as they are, these emotional self-centered thoughts that we fuss with all the time. Well, that's no small undertaking. We don't want to see them, and then we're also kind of appalled at ourselves when we start to look. It's a little hard to stand our own stink, sort of. And we have to practice with a really a kind of a tender, forgiving mind, or you won't be able to tolerate looking at yourself. You know, shame is not productive. We all know it, but it's like a lid on what actually needs to be seen. And as long as the lid is pressing us down, we can't get at what's behind it, which really doesn't deserve shame. It's a problem. It's maybe we've made mistakes. Maybe we're stupid, even a little bit, you know. But it's so like everybody else. To be shamed about it means we can't look at it and inform it and bring some fresh light to it. So then what we do is we get ashamed of feeling ashamed. See, right? This is like when you do zazen and you realize you've been strictly out to lunch and you say, oh, stupid, you did it again. Yeah. That's completely unnecessary. That's destructive. This little body does not need to be kicked in the shins. It's oh, look, I've actually woken up again. I have been out to lunch, yes, and here I am, able to acknowledge and avow that. To say, yes, once again, I've been out to lunch. This is the Tozen side. It says, yes, once again, here I am, I've been out to lunch. For the rest of my life, I will be compelled by empty thoughts. It will happen over and over. It won't just progress to where it doesn't happen again. But I can at any moment say, yes, here I am. Say, already I'm here. Yes, here I am. With having, avowing that, yes, I am, once again, have been out to lunch. That's the entire form of repentance in Zen practice, is this shining a light, saying, oh, here it is again, here I am again. And I can avow this. And then, without having to divert yourself into the shame and the guilt and all of that stuff and wear yourself out with that, or not look, you're already present here without all that extra baggage. She described this in terms of first seeing these self-centered thoughts as they are, and then observing them until they're so neutral that we can enter the experience that they carry, the experience of suffering, the experience of disappointment, the experience of fear. Otherwise, we just get rid of the idea that we are unhappy with something about ourselves. We don't actually get rid of the being unhappy with ourselves unless we can actually enter that sense of unhappiness or fear. When we experience the suffering directly, the melting of the false kind of emotion, the self-centered ideas can begin, and true compassion can emerge. She said, most people who don't do any kind of practice are pretty selfish, caught up in desires to be important, to possess things, not to die, to be rich, to be famous even. And of course, she said, that's true of all of us to a degree. And then most of us find that isn't true. That way of life doesn't work, and that's one of the primary reasons for turning to a practice like this, to give some shape to that disillusionment or to some idea of searching for something beyond the ways we've tried and haven't worked so well. So, she says, then we begin a second stage. Well, if it doesn't work to be selfish, I'm going to be unselfish. Most religious practices and some Zen practices, I'm sorry to say, are about unselfishness. I'm quoting Joko here. Seeing our meanness, our unkindness, which are really with us, we decide to pursue a new desire to be kind, good, and patient. And guilt goes along with this desire like a baby brother. When we don't fulfill our picture of how we should be, we feel guilty. We're still trying to be something we're not. And it leads not only to a kind of a kind of impoverishment and a sense of guilt, but also leads to a kind of arrogance or self-righteousness because we're on the right path and they aren't. She says all wanting, especially wanting to be a certain way, including to be a kind something or as well as a rich something, is centered on fear, she said. She said, if I can be perfect or I can be realized, I will take care of that fear, the fear that I'm really nothing much and that I'm a poor, a weak specimen and that suffering is going to dog me forever and I'm going to be buried in it. All these fears, the fear that no one will love me, the fear that I shouldn't, don't really deserve it anyway. All of these fears run around. And if I can be a certain way, and maybe being perfect or realized or enlightened, I'll take care of that fear. If I'm good enough, I'll take care of that fear. Do you see the desire there, she said? There's a tremendous desire to move away from what I am into an ideal. So she went on, to move from being selfish and greedy to trying not to be that way is like taking down all the drab and ugly pictures in your room and putting up pretty ones. But if that room is a prison cell, you've changed the decorations and they look a little better, but the freedom you want isn't there. You're still imprisoned in the same room. Changing the pictures on the wall from greed, anger, and ignorance into ideals, and not of kindness and generosity, improves the decorations but leaves us without freedom, including the freedom to be generous. So then she tells a story, and she was writing, talking about this in her book, about a king who wants to find the wisest of his subjects to be his next prime minister. And he winnows it down to three candidates. And they're all deeply intelligent and thoughtful people. How is he going to choose the one who's actually wise? So he puts them in one room together, and installs an elaborate lock on the door and says that whoever is the first one to leave the room, to be able to get to leave the room, will be his prime minister. So two of them sit down and take everything they've ever learned and understood and try to go into complex calculations about algorithms, about how, what is he, could he be thinking, how, what kind of a lock would he construct, what would it be like, how can I find my way through it and out of it. And the third one sits there quietly. Mm-hmm. And then he gets up, opens the door, and goes out of the room. It wasn't locked. He installed the lock, but he didn't lock the door. So then she said, well, so what's the point for us? The prison cell we live in, whose walls we are frantically redecorating, is not a prison cell, and the door has never been locked. We don't need to sit in our cells and struggle arduously to try to change ourselves because we are already free. But merely to say this doesn't solve the problem, of course. How can we realize, making real, actualize, embody, and live out this fact of freedom? She says, what we need is to go to the third stage. Seeing through the futility of the first two stages, which were selfishness and the unselfishness agenda, becoming a patient and persistent witness to this whole parade. See, we have to be willing to see ourselves wanting what we want, and then wanting to be the better person, and how we're just repapering the walls of our cell. We have to be able and willing to see these things, bearing witness. Then, she said, the third stage emerges naturally, simply to experience the truth of each moment. When we experience ourselves as we are, the impatience and fear and anger begin to resolve themselves, because they are not larger than us. For beginning, when we push them away or have all these agendas, the really fear is that our anger and fear and ignorance are so terrible, and we are such reprobates that they are in fact larger than we are. And in fact, actually, they are not larger than we are. They're here within us. Maybe we see them as a large part of ourselves, but they're part with other parts. They're, and we can see them, and when then seen, they lose some of the compulsive grip they seem to have on us. So our practice is about making fear conscious, because the only thing that is holding the impatience in our place, holding our fear, anger, and impatience in our in place, is our thoughts. So we have to be. So she has this witnessing and attending to our thoughts. What is it that we are thinking? What kind of thoughts are they? What kind of emotions are we having? And what are they about? She said, we back out of unreality by witnessing it, seeing it for what it is. We fall into reality, she said. Then what she said, when we can spend, she said 90%, that's a lot, 90% of our time being with life as it is, we're going to see what life is. But actually, in this sort of repeating universe, every time we do this, we see what life is. She's saying that if we do this practice over and over and over, returning here and now, arriving in this place and moment where we really are, and being here in a way that is not bedeviled by our thoughts, but still we know instead what they are like and what our emotions and feelings are like, and the ways in which some of them become terrible blockages. It's not the fact of having thoughts or feeling that's the problem. It's the way they become compulsive narratives and agendas, and we identify ourselves with them. Every time we do this, dropping off, we enter the realm of being present here and now with life as the Bodhisattva, being free as Buddha. And the next moment another thought comes up. And then we go to the Tozen school, you see, which is endlessly, I will be compelled by empty thoughts. Oh, okay. Perfection. It's perfect patience and unselfishness is not in the cards. It's not appropriate. It's impossible and inappropriate to the reality of life. To take care of real, teeming, beautiful life as it really is to be able to and willing to over and over accept the reality of being compelled by our thoughts and seeing that happen, letting that go, returning here and now, being present, and stepping forward again. And again and again. So, in a sense, Joko had a method, although she probably wouldn't have liked that word for it, because it's that tends to become its own closed system. She had a practice based on witnessing the feeling you're having right now, the thought you're having right now, the body state you're having right now. It's kind of a combination, as I said, of mindfulness and the just sitting practice. It's a way of bringing yourself right here and now and not being completely swamped and absorbed in those thoughts. But there are, so that, as she said, the light that shined on them helps them melt. They lose some of their grip. There are two kinds of traps in this kind of practice of witnessing, which she brings in various places, I think, as well. If you keep focusing on what you see, you can build your cell walls higher instead of melting them. That's one of the reasons she emphasized working with a teacher. If we only do what we already know how to do, you know, it's really hard. So Zazen, as Uchiyama Roshi said, is your truest teacher. You sit doing Zazen, and you sit here, and you keep aiming at arriving here and now, you're going to learn a lot about yourself. Still, we can get sort of fixated on following what this thought is and what that feeling is, on the witnessing and attending to them, which reinforces them. Has the wrong effect. So you can either get kind of use that kind of practice instead to kind of get keep that narrow focus on what I'm thinking and feeling, or you can find in the kind of focus and the light that shines on them, and that sense that can come of freedom, you can get a kind of heady sense of freedom and believe that now you're enlightened. And that's another kind of prison cell. And it's really a worse one. This is a dangerous and so-called enlightenment, or an experience of freedom, is to believe that now it's that way, when everything else in life is changing. But not that, right? 'Cause I got it and I don't want to let it go. So what happens then is that we enter a new prison cell that doesn't, we don't even know, we want to look for a door. We don't even know if it has a door, because we think we're in this place called peace, or this place called enlightenment. We're the sitting still for a bit, realizing that I'm sitting in a small, close, tight place, and that I can open a door and walk out, that I'm not really in a locked cell, is something we do over and over and over and over, because the mind will over and over tend to build itself inadvertently into a prison cell. It'll start by saying, "Isn't this lovely? I want more." Or, "Yes, I'm here and now. I'm here and now. He's not." You know, we start to build the me versus you. The mind goes there. It rather naturally goes there. One of the benefits of many years of practice is you're likely to see it sooner, some of the time. But if you believe that you'll always see it sooner, you're back in the prison cell again, because then you stop looking. Choko said, "It may be confusing at times, but have enough faith and need and drive to just do your practice. Be very patient and respect yourself for doing this practice." That's very important, to respect yourself for doing this practice. And eventually, if we're patient enough and work hard enough, we have some possibility of making a real contribution to the world. You could say, eventually, if we're patient enough and work hard enough, we have some possibility of awakening, or knowing that we have a practice of awakening that we're doing over and over. And those are not separate statements. That's one of the things that we only wake up to over time, is that the practice of awakening in Zazen is no different from the practice, is the same thing as making a real contribution to the world. In this oneness that we finally learn to live in, that's where the love is. Not some kind of a soupy version, but a love with real strength. We want it for our lives, and we want it for others' lives. This transformation of the quality of human life is the most important thing we can do. Her teachings are still alive and fresh, of great value. So that's my tour for today of Joko's teachings and my response to them. Some of it was hers word, some of it was mine. Why don't we say, the clear parts are Joko. I'll take responsibility for the mixing together and mixing up. So, thoughts, responses?